Safe in Our Arms is made possible through a grant from the Binghamton Rotary Charities and the generous support of listeners like you. Thanks for your support.
Welcome to Safe in Our Arms, a WSKG News special. I'm Crystal Sarakis. This is a show about guns, but not about gun control laws. There's been a lot of talk about gun control already, and it seems agreement there is pretty far off. But maybe there are ways to make guns safer without restricting them. Any consensus starts with talking, with a conversation. That's a hard thing to do when it comes to guns, according to Dr. Harry Wilson. He's the author of Guns, Gun Control, and Elections, The Politics and Policy of Firearms. Wilson says the logjam over guns relates to political polarization in general.
What we see is people almost essentially living in different worlds, that people living in one world view firearms from one perspective, and people living in the other world on the other side view firearms in a completely different way. One side sees them essentially as weapons of destruction, and the other side essentially sees them as tools and, in some cases, forms of recreation.
It also seems that when we have these conversations around guns, it almost always follows in the wake of some sort of tragic event like a mass shooting. So are the conversations that happen in the wake of this just too emotional sometimes?
Well, I think we see those conversations because that's when the policy window is really open for supporters of stricter gun laws. We know from policymaking and theories of policymaking that those windows of opportunity don't stay open for very long periods of time, and they usually follow an event that focuses everyone's attention on that issue. And clearly and sadly, mass shootings do that for gun control. In periods where we don't see those events, then public opinion generally starts moving in favor of gun rights, and those who advocate for stricter gun laws are just not likely to win any political battles.
Do you think that we focus too much on mass shootings when it comes to the greater context of talking about guns and how to make these safer in our communities?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. And I think that's one area where certainly at least researchers on both sides of the issue, I think, would tend to agree with that. That we focus far too much on mass shootings, and it's understandable why we do that, because they're so grotesque and because they're much more likely to be in the news than, for lack of a better term, a run-of-the-mill murder, run-of-the-mill homicide. So we spend much more time looking at those. But in reality, those events, very fortunately for us as a society, are extremely uncommon, and they constitute a very small percentage of homicides in general and constitute an extremely small percentage of firearm-related homicides.
Many policy experts agree that the policies or legislation that's proposed in the wake of these mass shootings and that policy window that you talked about would actually have little to no impact on preventing another mass shooting. So are there things that would reduce the risk of these horrific events?
The mass shootings are really very difficult to prevent. People don't like to talk about that, and people don't like to admit it, but they're very difficult to prevent. And what that means is if you don't know who, or you sort of don't know how, and you don't know when, how do you try to prevent that from happening? By most estimates today, even if one wanted to restrict AR-style rifles, which is of questionable value, I would argue, but even if one wanted to do that, most estimates are there are somewhere between 7 and 10 million of those out there now, maybe even more than that. How do you begin to get those back? You can't. When we've enacted laws such as this, they have all been prospective. They've all been going out into the future and restricting future sales. But that means that all these weapons are out there and essentially already available.
Well, if we're talking about how hard it is to prevent mass shootings, let's talk about gun violence in general. Are there things that communities or policy could do that would reduce the risk of gun violence in general?
I think even that, sadly, it's extremely difficult to do. There are things we can do. We can, and these are going to be perhaps minimally useful, minimal impact, but minimal impact is better than no impact. I think education is very useful in this regard. We talk about passing, and many states have passed child safety laws and ammunition storage laws and things like that. But the reality is, in the privacy of one's home, those laws are no more effective than laws restricting types of sexual behavior between individuals in their own home, which is to say they're completely and totally ineffective. We've never been able to legislate common sense, and we never will be able to legislate common sense. We certainly do have for background checks now through FFLs, federal firearms licensees. People have to go through a background check. That does prevent some people from buying firearms. There certainly is the argument that they can get them elsewhere if they want to. And there's still the old argument that if you really want to do harm to another person, you will find a way to do that, whether one can procure a firearm or one can't.
Well, one of the things that seems everybody is on board with is improving mental health care systems to prevent gun violence and, I think, by extension, violence in general. Have there been successful programs or policies that have done that?
I'm not sure about the answer specifically to that question about how effective they are. I mean, what I can say is I don't think that there is a downside to improved mental health policies. So I think most people agree that this is, gun rights supporters are not opposed to policies that would improve mental health. They're opposed to some policies, as we saw most recently with the Obama executive order restricting firearms among older Americans who had in some way been found or requiring help with their financial transactions. The argument was that, well, these people may be mentally unstable. They've been unfit in this regard, so we should take their firearms as well. Gun rights groups offered very strong opposition to that, and that executive order has been undone by President Trump. But the argument there was these people are having their rights taken away from them without due process or anything else, because someone is having difficulty adding up numbers does not mean they've become violent in some way, shape, or form. So there are always going to be some of those disagreements. But I think in general, improving mental health services, no one's opposed to that. So there are some things that we can do, but honestly, these are all going to be, around the edges. And one thing we do need to bear in mind in the overarching conversation of all this, we've seen a 20-plus year decline in homicides in the United States and in general in violent crime, even through a recession when criminologists and, I'll say, so-called experts such as myself would have predicted an increase in homicides and an increase in violent crime. And we've seen decreases. That trend, in fairness, has leveled off. And in some major cities last year, we did see some increases in the past year or two. We've seen increases in homicides. And people are now beginning to think maybe we are at the end of this. But the homicide rate in the United States is nothing compared to what it was in the late 80s and early 1990s.
I want to shift tracks a little bit and talk about the role that education plays in helping to make guns safer in a household or in a community. One of the stories that I found interesting in my research was Eddie the Eagle, which was a pretty straightforward program that is still used in some parts of the country where you have this character, and I think the program is geared more toward young children, where it's simply, if you see a gun, leave it alone, go find an adult. But even that was a little bit controversial. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. That was controversial because people argued the argument that some gun control advocates made was essentially likening Eddie Eagle to Joe Camel. And, while Joe Camel was a cartoon character, in some sense, Joe Camel was also promoting the smoking of cigarettes. They said Eddie Eagle is still promoting firearms and firearm usage, even though the message is, and the message clearly in all of that campaign was and still is, right, if you see a gun, back away, don't touch it, call an adult. I don't think anyone can disagree with that message. But the argument was, well, they're doing this with an attractive cartoon character. Therefore, essentially, the subliminal message, if you will, for children is guns are fun, guns are cool, and it's okay for you to play with guns. I would take the educational campaign at, honestly, I would take it at face value, and I believe that the intent of the NRA there was not to inculcate a young cohort of shooters, if you will, but it was to teach gun safety. Now, some of their other shooting programs for youth clearly are aimed at, and they also emphasize safety, by the way, but those are clearly aimed at increasing the number of younger people who engage in the shooting sports and potential firearms owners in the future. But those are clearly geared in that direction. And Eddie Eagle, I would argue, was not. But I think that also gets to sort of that one side really doesn't talk to the other.
So we don't talk about it. And it's clear that people disagree on this issue. So maybe it's best that we don't talk about it at all?
I'm not sure that it's best that we don't talk about it at all. I think what we need to try to do, and this is very difficult, but we need to try to find some common language to use, and we need to try to find a way of putting ourselves in the position of the other person. For example, in the state of New York, guns are seen very differently, and support for gun control and views of firearms are very different in New York City than they are in upstate New York. And that's for very obvious reasons, because guns mean very different things in New York City than they do in upstate New York. People need to sort of understand that, but people need to understand also that there are folks that live in other areas. And I think what we sort of encounter more often than not is that everyone looks at it from their own perspective, and no one ever looks at it from the other person's perspective and says, oh, somebody might be able to look at these things in a different way than I do. What both sides seem intent on doing is convincing the other side that they are wrong. And one thing I think we clearly demonstrate on all political issues is the more strongly I try to convince you that you are wrong, the more likely you are to dig in your heels and to be convinced that, in fact, you are correct and that I'm the one that's wrong. That's not persuasive. Persuasion is actually sitting down and trying to talk to people and saying, okay, what can we do about this? Tell me about your perspective and let me tell you about my perspective. And let's see if there's someplace we can sort of meet here. Maybe there isn't. But the worst thing that happens there is you become familiar with someone else's perspective.
Well, if we want to talk about this dialogue and seeing it from the other person's side, does this happen in the state houses or does it first happen in the living room and somebody saying, you know, hey, I'm uncomfortable that you want to take my guns away. And the other person saying, I'm uncomfortable that you're going out fully armed and kitted out at the restaurant.
I think it can happen in either place. Right now, it's not happening in either place. There's a debate within political science, whether sort of the political polarization that we see today really originated with elected officials, primarily Congress, or if it originated with citizens. I'm not sure that chicken and egg question really makes much of a difference. The reality is that we see political polarization, certainly on gun control policy, but on a variety of other issues as well. And we see that at all levels today. And I think anyone can try to break through that gridlock, although it's very difficult. Many people would argue elected officials should lead the way on that. I can't disagree with it, but I do know that elected officials on both sides of the aisle today get punished if they try to do that. One of the things that I found in some of my research about firearms is that it isn't really just, we talk about the differences between gun owners and people who don't own guns, particularly in public opinion, and those are very big differences. But one of the differences there also is simply familiarity with firearms. It is not only a function of do I own a firearm or do I go shooting, but it's a function of are any of those firearms in my household? Do I know people who own guns? Do I know people who hunt or do I know people who go to a shooting range? And if the answer to that is yes, then people are much less likely to be fearful of firearms and frankly, they're much less likely to support stricter gun laws.
Do you see a path forward on this issue?
There's not a clear path forward, no, I don't think. But again, I would liken that, I would say this is symptomatic of the greater political polarization that we see in the country. Because if you asked me right now, do I see a path forward on a wide variety of other issues in the country, my answer would also be no.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot of work to do as a, as a country and a society.
Yeah, it sounds, sadly, it sounds like I'm not a very optimistic person. I apologize for that. I'd like to think that I'm relatively optimistic. And if people, I think it is possible, but it is just extremely difficult. Often we don't even know people on the other side to talk to.
Well, Dr. Wilson, thank you for talking with me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Harry Wilson is director for the Institute of Policy and Opinion Research at Roanoke College in Virginia. Up next, an effort to reduce suicides that links the gun world to the non-gun world. This is Safe in Our Arms. This is Safe in Our Arms. I'm Crystal Sarakis. Nationally, almost 50% of all suicides involve firearms. Amy McCracken is deputy commissioner in the Ulster County Department of Mental Health.
People use many different methods to attempt to kill themselves, but due to the lethality of guns, the capacity to get medical attention really quickly, people die much more quickly when they use a gun versus other means.
In partnerships across the country, mental health professionals like McCracken and gun enthusiasts are trying to do something about suicide. One such partnership is in Ulster County, New York, in the Hudson Valley. There, McCracken and others are working with Joe Leone of the Federated Sportsmen's Clubs of Ulster County. McCracken and her colleagues have started going to gun shows. They distribute flyers and talk to gun buyers and sellers about suicide. McCracken says it's about gun safety, not gun control.
So we go to a gun show, and here we are, a suicide prevention table amongst individuals selling many different types of guns, many of which I've never seen before. And we encourage people to come to the table. We raffle off a gun lock box while we're sitting there. We always have free gun locks. And we begin to engage folks at these shows, at these events, in the discussion of gun safety towards our efforts of suicide prevention. And we found in doing so that many people who own guns have the experience of having lost a loved one to suicide. And I would say at least every fifth person that came to the table would have some kind of experience that was pretty powerful and meaningful, and they were really quite appreciative that we were there helping to teach people how to protect themselves and their family members.
Was that surprising to you that so many people had that personal story associated with suicide?
It was surprising to me that so many people started talking about it as comfortably and easily as they did to virtual strangers. You know, we were strangers. We were sitting behind a table. What it taught me, at least at that very first show that we went to, was how much people needed to talk about this, and that we as a society needed to talk about suicide and suicide prevention. And I know that there's one of the myths is that if you talk about suicide, you're going to plant it and plant the thought in someone's mind. And that's so inaccurate. Actually, what we really know is that openly and directly talking about suicide is a significant key to the prevention of suicide.
It was a little scary to have the Ulster County Mental Health come to a gun show after I suggested it. I go, oh my God, they're going to be sitting in the middle at a table with thousands of guns around. And they were right at home. So it's not about gun control. It's about keeping people from committing suicide. So when somebody hangs himself, it's not about, well, if he didn't have a rope or a cord in the house, he wouldn't have committed suicide. So when there's a gun in the house and he uses the gun, it's not the gun. We need to be able to identify when somebody needs the help, get the help out there. And that's what the Ulster County Health Department is showing us. What are the signs?
What are some of the warning signs that would put you on alert for a gun buyer who might be a suicide risk?
Somebody comes in, has no gun experience at all, and all of a sudden wants to purchase a gun. What are you going to use the gun for? Well, if it's not for sport shooting, target shooting, or whatever, you can usually feel them out. You can usually identify somebody that doesn't have any gun experience at all. And after talking with people, you should be able to figure it out. And that's what we're learning. The last person that wants to see somebody use a firearm to hurt themselves is a gun owner.
I just wanted to add that one of the other flyers that we created is specifically for individuals who sell guns, that indicates, has on it signs that a potential buyer could be suicidal, options for responding to that buyer.
Well, Joe, I wanted to ask you, in working with people who sell guns, are they receptive to having this information that might, you know, help them understand what those warning signs and risks are?
Yes, as soon as they, Ulster County Mental Health went to the first show, some of the dealers signed up already and have the placards, the banners, with the brochures and information right on their counters. And they advise their people what to look out for, and it's an education thing.
But it's also spread to the Ulster County Fair. We get invited to the Ulster County Fair with the Federation. That brings a whole different kind of group of people to get information on suicide prevention. We've been invited to many veterans events, local veterans events. And both in the provision of information on warning signs about suicide, but also it's spread a little bit into what are the different services that Ulster County has available. So it's in response to that question to Joe, what's the receptivity? We've been really surprised at the warmth and desire to have our coalition be present at many different kinds of gun-associated events.
And a lot of veterans later in life, you know, go through depressions and things like this. And these guys don't want to reach out, because if they reach out and the law gets involved, they're going to lose their firearms. And a lot of these guys have sport hunted or target shot for, shooting for years, and they don't want to lose that right. So they're a little afraid to reach out. So the idea is let the sportsmen get the guns away from them instead of the law. And get the mental health or the medical help that they need. A person that has lost a family member, lost a job, you know, these are the telltale signs.
So what do you both advise the salesperson at a gun show to do when he or she is encountered with someone who may be exhibiting these warning signs, that they're feeling, you know, this may be a situation?
If it's at a gun show or if it's at a gun shop, if you're not the owner of the gun shop, so a salesperson would want to notify the owner that they're uncomfortable with this particular person. They can urge the customer with a little firearm experience to seek training before buying. They can ask the customer why she wants to buy the firearm, suggest that the customer take some time to think it over before buying. Ask if the individual that's buying the gun is buying it for self-defense, or if they are buying it for self-defense, they can buy pepper spray instead of a gun. Ask the person directly if they're suicidal. I'm a social worker, I'm a clinician, trained to ask that question, after 30 years, it's an easy question for me to ask. It's not an easy question for someone who's not necessarily a clinician or in the field, but it's so important to just be direct. Ask the question if they're suicidal. And if they are, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number. It's okay not to sell a gun to a particular person on a particular day. Trust your instincts.
Joe, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, that's actually how it is. The person behind the counter has the authority, working for anyone, has that authority that if they feel something is wrong, that they don't go through with the purchase of the firearm. And they'll, most of these people are trained. Dealing with the public, it's back and forth. You get a lot of sense of it. Having this training in the back of their mind is going to help them look for something else. If a person doesn't pass a background check, they may go to another store and have a member of their family try to obtain the gun. and the gun shops contact each other and say, this particular person with this name, last name, came in looking for this particular gun. And that stops a lot of the illegal stuff. Well, that can also stop a suicide. If a person came in and wanted to purchase a gun at one shop and they felt a little strange about it, they'll contact the other dealers in the area. They'll work together.
I want to add that the New Hampshire Gun Shop Project started a number of years ago when a gun owner, I think it's Riley's Gun Shop in New Hampshire, was owned by Ralph D'Amico. And he experienced three suicides from individuals who purchased guns in his shop within 6 days. And it was devastating for him. And he reached out to create what eventually began the New Hampshire Gun Shop Project. So this, ours came from social workers, but the New Hampshire Gun Shop Project, which for us is our lead, is our guide, started with a gun shop owner that had this experience.
Well, along with safety, is suicide something that you talk about with the sportsmen's groups?
Yes, Ulster County Mental Health came out and did a seminar at one of our monthly meetings for the Federation, and some of the clubs had asked them to come out to their club meetings to discuss it.
Amy, what about gun shops? Did you reach out to gun shops about this program, and what happened when you did that?
Oh, we did reach out to gun shops. Most were receptive. I would say that not all are continuing to display the information. There is one in Saugerties that absolutely has taken this on as part of what it is that they do in their retail business, and they display the material that we have. They continue to request more material if they've run out. They'll sometimes make their own copies. The larger gun shops that are more commercial require different kinds of permissions that are very difficult to get to display suicide prevention information or information that's not related to their organization.
Would those be big companies like Dick's or Gander Mountain?
Those would be the more commercial shops, yes.
Have you had any success in reaching out to corporate offices on that regard?
I'm going to throw that to Joe.
I did work for one of the box stores for quite a while, and that's the only one that had it in there. And I didn't get permission from the corporate end on it, but I did have permission from the store manager. So I was able to, get that in there. But it's tough because you're dealing with a corporate office from a different state. And a lot of times they might feel funny about displaying suicide prevention material, but on a local level, it's not a problem.
If you could send a message to those corporate office people, what would that be?
It's to everybody's benefit to have an understanding of the importance of firearm safety and suicide prevention.
And with the National Shooting Sports Foundation now being involved in it, with American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, these are national organizations. This will get to the corporate world. This will get to the stores.
Joe, do you know if the trainings yet may have had an impact in someone's life within the groups that you work in?
I haven't heard anything back, but the more it gets spread out there, I think then we'll start hearing things back. But a lot of guys interact with other gun guys, hang out together. They go to the range together. They hunt together. They go to the clubs together. It's like a volunteer firehouse type of community. Same guys, your volunteer firemen also belong to gun clubs. So it's all in the community. We just want them to have the background so that they notice when there's a problem. Sometimes dealing with somebody on a daily basis, you don't see what the problems are. We need to know more about depression and things like that.
What has been the hardest thing about getting this program implemented?
We didn't talk about guns in our Suicide Prevention Coalition. We talked about training. We talked about warning signs. And we had to really start to shift our own thinking as a coalition to become really okay with going to a gun show, to kind of putting ourselves, you know, in this kind of situation. And I'm going to say, you know, Joe Liuni, along with chief of police from one of our local police departments, it's a member of the Suicide Prevention Coalition, really helped us kind of shift our mindset, open our mindset. And once we made that shift, and that was pretty early on, once we made that shift, it hasn't been difficult at all.
Joe, what about you? What's been the hardest thing?
Actually, once it got rolling, it was fairly easy. It was just the first couple of steps. We're gun people. We're going to sit down with doctors and psychiatrists and stuff like that. And we're not even in the same playing field, but actually we are. They understood our problems. We understood their problems. And we've always thought that, you know, every time we open a paper up and there's a shooting or whatever, it's been a mental health issue. There's a lot of programs that the state of New York comes up with. There's 80 to 100 anti-gun, anti-hunting bills that go through the state assembly every year. Fortunately, we get to block most of them. We weren't able to block the New York State Safe Act. That had a lot of stuff in it, a lot of money involved in it against guns. And some of those provisions in the SAFE Act were also against the mental health professionals. They had to change the way they do to the thing, also looked at things because they could be liable under that law. They're looking at $30 to $40 million to come up with a program to do a background check to buy a box of ammunition. They haven't come up with it in 4 years. The money's still sitting there. They're looking at this micro stamping, which is fantasy technology. And that'll be $30 or $40 million worth of state money wasted on that that won't work. That money should be going to other programs, and suicide prevention, mental health should be where it's going.
Amy, you have some information that you wanted to share before we wrap up.
Yes, I wanted to make sure that that everybody has the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. This is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week phone number where people can call if they're concerned about someone at risk for suicide or feeling suicidal themselves, and I'm going to give you that number. It's 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-8255.
Amy and Joe, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Crystal.
Amy McCracken is Deputy Commissioner in the Ulster County Department of Mental Health. Joe Liuni is President of the Federated Sportsmen's Clubs of Ulster County. You can find more information about their partnership and about suicide prevention at ulstercountyspeak.org. Coming up, personalized guns may be coming to a gun shop near you. This is Safe in Our Arms. This is Safe in Our Arms. I'm Crystal Sirakis. The technology and tools that we use every day are getting smarter. Think of self-driving cars and appliances that are connected to the internet. Well, soon personalized guns may be a way to prevent deaths. I'm joined by Stephen Tarrant. He's founding director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Tarrant, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
There are a few different technologies that can make guns smart or childproof. It's probably too much to detail all of them, but could you give us a couple of examples of the technology that exists today?
Yes, the technologies fall into one of two areas. One is called biometric technology, and that looks at something that's particular about an individual, like a fingerprint. That's the most common biometric technology that's being used. The other is called RFID technology, and that stands for radio frequency identification. And the way that RFID technology works is that the person who's authorized to use the gun has on him or her, it could be a wristwatch, a bracelet, a ring, a pin, and that electronically communicates with the gun. The gun picks up that signal that's being transmitted to it, and something moves in the gun that had been blocking the firing mechanism. It moves, so now the gun is operable. But if someone took the gun from you, then the gun wouldn't be operable because it wouldn't be close enough to that RFID transmitter.
And biometrics, is that like a fingerprint or palm scan?
Yes, it's principally a fingerprint. There are other types of biometrics that can be used and have been tried. The gun can be programmed so that it accepts more than one fingerprint. So if you and your spouse want to be able to use the gun, you can have two fingerprints. If you're a police department and you want 30 police people to be able to use that same gun, it can be programmed for 30 fingerprints.
Now, we all know that technology doesn't always work the way that we want it to. So if you're in a self-defense situation and you have a gun that operates in one of these ways and there's a lag time between the time that you pick up the gun and it's unlocked to fire, could that mean the difference between life and death?
Well, first, we should clarify something. When we're talking about these guns, we shouldn't be giving the impression that these guns are out there on the market now. They're not yet on the market. They're about to come on the market, but it's not that you can go out and buy one. When they do come on the market, the time lag will be measured in milliseconds. So, no, that doesn't pose any threat to the person who wants to use the gun.
When will they be available on the market?
One manufacturer says that they're going to be available probably sometime in the next few months. That manufacturer is called Armatix. Some people pronounce it Armatix. Other manufacturers are preparing their guns to be ready for manufacture, but they're not quite there yet. They're lagging behind a little bit.
So what is the advantage of owning a smart gun over a traditional gun?
Every year there are some tragic deaths where a young child finds a gun in the house. Maybe the young child doesn't even perceive the difference between a real gun and a toy gun. The young child points the gun at a sibling or a playmate, pulls the trigger, and oftentimes a life is taken. So you can make the gun childproof by making it a smart gun or a personalized gun. I use both those terms interchangeably, smart gun and personalized gun. Another category of lives that would be saved are some suicides. Most people don't realize that the greatest number of gun deaths in the United States are not accidental. They're not the homicides, but they're suicides. And some of those suicides are teenage suicides. The gun should not be operable for that depressed teenager, and if it were a smart or personalized gun, it wouldn't be operable. The last category of lives that would probably be saved are homicides. There are between 250,000 and 500,000 guns stolen from homes during home burglaries every year, and those guns enter the illicit market. And they end up on the street and are involved in mayhem, including homicides. People often ask, well, exactly how many lives would be saved? And nobody has an answer to that. It's impossible to answer that because we haven't run the experiment yet. We haven't put the guns on the marketplace. But many people, including myself, are confident that the number of lives saved will be enough, that it certainly warrants bringing these guns into the marketplace.
Gun rights advocates seem to be very much against most of these technologies, though. Why is that?
Well, that's a question that has a very, very long answer to it. Some gun rights people are against it because they think that the gun is not going to be reliable. The irony is that the guns that exist now are not reliable. There's a failure rate for guns. Once you put electronics into guns, then guns would actually become more reliable than they are now. So the argument that the gun would not be reliable is a specious argument. We shouldn't put any faith in that kind of argument. Then there are people who say, well, they just don't like any kind of change, and they certainly don't want the government to mandate change. But we're not talking about mandating change. We're talking about letting the market forces do what they normally do, that if guns are on the market that are smarter, safer consumer products and people want to buy it, then the market forces will tell manufacturers that they ought to be changing all of their guns to smart guns over time.
And actually, we saw this happening in New Jersey. New Jersey tried to mandate this with the law that they passed in 2002. That law may have had unintended consequences. What happened? Can you explain that for us?
Yes, I can. I wrote the law, so I'm familiar with it. So yes, the law was passed in 2002, and what that law said is that as soon as a smart gun is offered for sale anywhere in the United States, and that gun is certified as the law actually calls them personalized gun, it's certified as meeting the statutory definition of personalized guns, and the certification is done by the New Jersey State Attorney General, then over a three-year period, ultimately the only new handgun that could be sold in New Jersey would be a smart gun. Now, what we've done is, because people are critical of that law, they're worried about it interferes with their rights. So for 2 years in a row, the New Jersey legislature amended that law and said any kind of gun can still be sold, but all licensed gun dealers in New Jersey would have to carry at least one smart gun in their stock of trade so that if people want to buy the gun, then they can. So the law really is giving people a right of choice to choose a safer gun. That bill was passed twice by both houses of the New Jersey legislature. The first time, Governor Christie didn't sign it, so that was called a pocket veto. And then New Jersey passed it again, and it went to Governor Christie, but that time he vetoed the bill.
Gun rights groups have a point, don't they, though, that smart guns may very well lead to laws that require all guns that are sold to be smart guns?
Well, I can't speculate as to whether they will lead to such laws. I guess I'm seen as one of the biggest proponents of smart guns, but I'm not pushing for all states to have a law that require that every gun be a smart gun. So yes, they are fearful of that, but I don't think that their fear is well-founded. But even if their fear was well-founded, even if all guns were smart guns, or at least all new guns were smart guns, that would reduce a number of gun deaths. It would allow people to have whatever gun they want in their home without worrying that the young child or the depressed teenager is going to pick it up and something terrible happening.
We've talked a little bit that they're not available on the market yet. Why aren't they available yet?
They're not available yet for a number of reasons. The first thing that delayed them coming to the market, and now I'm going back a couple decades, was that the technology had to be better developed. But we've achieved that. That's a hurdle that we've gotten over. Now the hurdles are economics, that it costs money to set up a factory to make a different kind of gun. And then there's also the cultural and political hurdle to get over.
Now, the idea of a childproof gun isn't new. Smith & Wesson manufactured a childproof gun in the late 1800s, and they sold it until well into the 20th century. And then in the early 2000s, Smith & Wesson was actually working on a new childproof gun, but faced a boycott over that. What happened there?
Smith & Wesson and the other manufacturers were being sued by localities and cities and states. They were being sued because the cities and states said, look, you make so many guns, you market them indiscriminately, and as a result, there's chaos on the street, people are getting shot, and that costs the municipality money, just as it costs the municipality money when people would smoke cigarettes and get lung cancer. So Smith & Wesson was hopeful of getting out from under the burden of some of these lawsuits. So they made an agreement that they would change their ways in two manners. One is that they would start to make a childproof gun again. And the second is that they would market their guns differently. And in consideration for that, Smith & Wesson would be dropped as a defendant in some of these lawsuits that had been brought. As soon as that became known to the pro-gun forces, there was a call for a boycott, and the boycott was very, very effective. It brought Smith & Wesson to its financial knees, and Smith & Wesson had to shut down some of its factories because they weren't getting orders for their guns. So ultimately, Smith & Wesson was sold at a bargain price to a different conglomerate, and the lesson that the gun industry learned was that if you break ranks, if you violate what the NRA wants to do, you'll be sorely punished. And that punishment still is vivid enough in the mind of many gun companies that they don't want to break ranks.
So if there is this potential rather large return on investment, as you say, for gun manufacturers, why are more not jumping on that already?
I think there are two reasons that explain their inaction. One is they remember what happened to Smith & Wesson years ago when it got punished by the NRA, and they don't want to be punished themselves. But the second one is that it's going to cost the gun manufacturers, the traditional gun manufacturers in the United States, like Smith & Wesson, Colts, Sturm, Ruger, it's going to cost them some money in research and development to catch up to these other companies that are about to market smart guns now. The position that these major companies have been in is quite enviable from their point of view. They're selling a gun that literally was designed in 1911 by John Browning. It's as though Ford Motor Company were still selling Model T cars without having to invest in coming up with new models every year to improve the product. So the gun companies haven't put any money into research and development, and they're reaping a handsome profit over the last 10 years. What they're going to have to do if they want to move into smart guns is either start putting money into research and development or else licensing the patent rights that others hold so that they can start making smart guns without violating patent rights.
So they're coming onto the market soon. What do you think will happen?
Well, it's hard to predict, but I do think that people will start buying the guns because they'll think, if I'm going to have a gun in the house, I'd rather have a safe gun rather than an unsafe gun. I think that whoever made the first move of bringing those guns to the marketplace is going to have a large return on its investment. And then I think the more traditional gun companies are going to say, we see the writing on the wall. We have to start making and selling smart guns or personalized guns also. And as a result of that, I think we'll see a reduction in the number of gun deaths in the United States.
Stephen Terrett is founding director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research at Johns Hopkins University. Stephen, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And now we go to a hunting class. You have to take one in person if you want to get your hunting license in New York, but some other states let you do it all online. As WSKG's Brett Jaspers reports, it's a trend hunting teachers in New York are hoping to stave off.
Good morning. How are we all doing today?
Good. How are you?
Do you have any questions from yesterday? Because that was actually your homework, wasn't it?
Bill Stevens doesn't have to teach a two-day class. He wants to. This time, day two is a cold Sunday morning in January at the Savona Rod and Gun Club in Steuben County. Stevens starts with a review of what a responsible hunter would do in the field.
Would they treat every firearm as it's loaded?
Yes.
Are you sure? Would they obey game laws?
Yes.
Would they use land without asking permission?
No.
Stevens is a volunteer, like all of New York hunter education teachers. There are over 2,000, including apprentice teachers.
Pull that lever back. Okay. And you're loaded.
Okay.
Cassidy Cerny is learning how to check if a gun is loaded before she crosses a fence. Cerny's from Ithaca, and like several of the students, brand new to hunting.
I have absolutely no knowledge on the subject whatsoever. I've never been hunting. I've never shot a gun other than a BB gun, so I wanted to learn and give myself potential to be able to go hunting or shooting anywhere if I wanted to.
The state created the Hunter Ed program in the late 1940s after a lot of World War II vets started hunting and getting accidentally shot. The classes have been mandatory for new hunters ever since. At the moment, instructors design their own classes under state guidelines. Stephen's class is part field training, part video, part lecture, and now part mandatory homework. As of last year, the state says all students must complete homework before coming to class. They can do it on paper or online. Stevens doesn't like mandatory homework because he has to turn people away if they don't do it. And he's worried this foreshadows a bigger change.
Not fact, but also rumor, is that eventually they'll get rid of the volunteers and do it online, which is what some of us are very worried about.
17 states now offer online-only hunting classes, although age and other requirements vary a lot. Every state does still offer a traditional in-person class. John Organ with the U.S. Geological Survey says online-only classes make training more accessible.
In many states, there's a backlog of students that want to get trained, and there's just not enough spaces.
New York State gets a rush of people wanting to take a hunter ed class every fall before deer hunting season. An online-only option would alleviate that. But the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation says it's not considering online-only classes. Frank Phillips is a DEC hunter education coordinator.
Would you want to allow someone to take an online driving test and then get their driver's license without seeing them drive a vehicle? I don't think it's any different with hunting.
But people learn differently, according to Brad Heidel. He runs an international association of hunter educators. Heidel says online only works just fine.
Kids these days, they learn not by hands-on, they learn by interaction with their computers, with their telephones.
Whatever your philosophy on education, it's a decision states want to make carefully. Various states are asking Heidel for reliable data on what kind of class works best. Matt Dunphy with the Wildlife Management Institute is designing a study. He says states are getting pressure to change.
State fish and wildlife agencies are being challenged more and more to adopt new technologies and new ways of doing things. What hasn't caught up with those new technologies and new ideas is data to inform those decisions.
The data should be out by the end of the year. Visiting Bill Stevens' class, it is hard to see how a student would learn some of the lessons through a computer. Here's an example. Stevens is portraying a hunter who's just killed his or her first deer and is prepping to gut the animal.
I'm going to be juiced, man, like every football player, baseball player. I'm going to be at the goalpost. Man, I got a deer! Woo-hoo! And the last thing I want to be doing is handling a very, very sharp knife while I'm all pumped up.
Have a calming ritual, he tells them. Good advice, right? But we all get good advice from teachers. The question is, do we retain it at the right moment? For now, New York is sticking with in-person hunter education. But you have to do your homework. In Steuben County, Brett Jaspers, WSKG News.
And that's it for Safe in Our Arms. You can find all of these segments online at WSKGnews.org. The show was produced by me, Crystal Sirakis, and Brett Jaspers, who also edited the show with help from Monica Sandreski. Special thanks to Carl Weldon at Ellen Bogan Studios in Ulster County. Thanks so much for listening. This is WSKG News.
Safe in Our Arms is made possible through a grant from the Binghamton Rotary Charities and the generous support of listeners like you. Thanks for your support.